Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the processes and politics of patronal systems.
Then how can countries with so many natural resources and mineral wealth remain in such poverty?
Last week, we began a two-part discussion with Henry Hale about his book, Patronal Politics. While many in the West decry the politics of the former Soviet Union countries as corrupt and anti-democratic, our guest argues that there are much better ways of understanding the processes and politics of patronal systems. Henry Hale is Associate Professor of Political Science and International Affairs and co-director of the Program on New Approaches to Research and Security in Eurasia. He's the author of Why Not Parties in Russia? Democracy, Federalism in the State, Developments in Russian Politics, and his latest, Patronal Politics. You noted in the book that we call this, from the West, corruption. To the people living in this, it's really just the way things are. Corruption, or what is considered corruption, varies from place to place. Like some might think our role of money in politics is corruption, whereas in the U.S., they consider it part of free speech.
Well, part of it has to do just with the technical definition, which is activities that are formally legalized generally are not called corrupt, at least by legalistic definition, because if they're done above board and following the law, they can't be prosecuted. But those very same activities, if they are not protected by law, might be considered corrupt in other societies. And I think that's very much the case, as you mentioned, with like lobbying or something like that in the United States. These practices would be illegal in many European countries that prohibit that sort of thing. But I think more generally, the issue kind of goes back to this idea of what people expect other people to be doing. Because if you expect that everybody else is behaving in ways that we would consider to be corrupt, people are put in this situation whereby they have to, make concrete choices about what to do and what's good and what's not. So, one of the examples that I give in the book, is about a member of parliament who his constituents might expect him to provide resources, right, to bring home pork. And if that legislator does not do that, he's a failure. But the only way for this legislator to bring back those resources might be to pay off people in the central government to try and get them to direct things his district's way. And so if he doesn't do this and stands up for his own morality, his own constituents not only might have a hard time, but they might be very upset at him for not doing his job. And those same resources will just be taken up by all the other people, right? All the other legislators who are playing ball, as it were. So from the perspective of that legislature, to actually get something good done for his district, which might involve very worthy things, building a university, paving the roads, building infrastructure to provide gas to poor regions, requires some sort of corrupt activities. And so it gets back to this issue of morality. In that situation, is that legislator really immoral to do that? Many people in those societies would say not, at the same time that they would think that the entire system is corrupt. So there's a great title of a book by Rasmus Karklins called The System Made Me Do It. And I think that there is some truth to that in the sense that when that kind of corrupt activity that we would call corrupt is so embedded, part of the problem is that at the individual level, it becomes rational and from a certain standpoint, arguably moral to go along with it. So the question then is how to, for reform then, is how do we change this entire system? How do we get people to start expecting that there can actually be a change and have those new expectations become deeply enough and thoroughly enough embedded in the system or implanted that people actually will start to change their behavior? And I think, unfortunately, historically, it's been very difficult to do. And even in most Western countries, this has been a phenomenon that, has become widespread beyond certain smaller communities, by some research accounts, only in recent centuries. So it's a very difficult problem.
Two of the exceptions that you wrote about from the former Soviet countries were Ukraine and Moldova. What was unique in their situations?
Well, one of the major questions that the book seeks to address is, in this kind of highly patronalistic context, what impact do formal rules make? And in this particular case, I focus on constitutions as sets of formal rules. So do constitutions matter at all when you have societies where laws are regularly disregarded? or at least aren't considered very important. And so one of the arguments of the book is that, in fact, they do matter. They just matter in a somewhat different way. And so in looking at the former Soviet space and looking at the different directions in which the regimes have gone, in general, where countries have had a constitution that gives the predominant power formally to a president, and you know, these are not dictatorial laws. I mean, they're laws not unlike those of France, for example, you know, where you have a strong president. Those presidentialist constitutions tend to combine with the paternalistic context of society to basically make that president not only a president in law, but a chief patron, basically a machine boss, kind of as the person around whom all these other power networks in society try to orient themselves. And so those societies where you've had presidential systems like Russia have tended to see a trend towards authoritarianism, punctuated occasionally by great political turmoil surrounding moments of succession. But what makes countries like Ukraine and Moldova stand out, I think, is that they have had other types of constitutions. And so they're among the exceptions in the former Soviet space. So Ukraine has had presidentialist constitutions at certain points in its history. But at the points in time where it was most democratic, where you had the most open and freewheeling political competition, it had a form of constitution that had a president, but that president did not have dominating political power, that basically alongside the president, you also had a parliament which would directly elect a prime minister. And so you had two executive authorities. You had a president that had some executive powers, and then a prime minister that had other executive powers. And the key is when those powers are sufficient in both sides to balance themselves out. And so I think that's what we've seen in Ukraine, in at least you know, for after the Orange Revolution, for example, between 2005 and 2010, was you had a pretty strong prime minister and a pretty strong president. Both sides at different points in time tried to usurp power, but neither side actually was able to dominate. And so, you know, you'd have one attempt to grab power offset by an equal and opposite application of the same kinds of manipulative machine political tactics by the other side. And so the result was a kind of democracy where you had vigorous competition, freewheeling media because both sides controlled media. But it wasn't really a great democracy because these were still political machines duking it out. You know, you didn't have like a great respect for the rule of law, which arguably you need for a democracy truly to be a well-functioning democracy. And I think that's one reason why average Ukrainians didn't think very much of this democracy. You know, they liked the political openness, but they saw that it really wasn't getting anything done. They were being still manipulated by media on different sides, constant stalemates. So the country was unable to find a solution to a major economic crisis in 2008 and 2009, basically had gridlock, permanent gridlock there, until finally people got fed up and voted in a guy who came back to power and instituted a presidentialist constitution. Moldova is slightly different because there you have a constitution that was what I call parliamentarist. That's what, I mean, it's not my term. A lot of political science research would use that term. And basically what that means is that an elected parliament fills all executive offices. So there is a parliament and a prime minister, but both are elected only by the parliament. And so there's no direct opportunity for the population directly to elect a president, for example. But what that means is that you have more opportunities for opposition to find their way into parliament and influence who becomes president and influence who becomes prime minister. So it doesn't lead to the same degree of concentration of power and authoritarianism, I think, as does a presidentialist system like Russia's. So I think that's why we've seen more open politics in Moldova and especially Ukraine over the years than we have in countries like Russia or Kazakhstan or Azerbaijan.
When you compared the former Soviet states with other parts of the world, you said these are a useful baseline for understanding these patterns in real politics. How are they a baseline?
Basically, I'm trying to think about how do these countries that I've focused so much attention on, the former Soviet states, relate to the rest of the world? What can we assume that the types of these cyclic dynamics that I've talked about, these kind of cycles between authoritarianization and democratization, what does that have to tell us about how politics might work in the rest of the world? Can we assume that other paternalistic countries work differently? And I don't think we can say that the former Soviet countries, the lessons there can be just uncritically applied to the rest of the world. And part of the reason is because the former Soviet experience, right, the experience of, at least in the case of the Soviet Union, 70 years of communist rule, altered these societies in ways that other societies haven't experienced. And I think part of what the communist experience did was kind of eliminate a lot of the other types of institutions that can affect politics. So concretely, you had a massive leveling of society. So landed interests, aristocracy, all of these kind of sources of inequality were largely wiped out by communist system. You had new forms of inequality start to emerge, but these were different. These weren't based in traditional inequalities, between an aristocracy, say, and a peasantry, but they had much more to do just with more contingent access to wealth. And so there was this kind of leveling of society. And plus, when the Communist Party collapsed, it really didn't leave much in its place. So, I mean, the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, like, really actually collapsed. And so it left this almost institutional vacuum. And so what there were lots of small-level institutions. So, you know, party cells or individual fragments or factories that were disconnected from a larger whole. Whereas in other societies, I think of countries like in Africa, for example, when the colonists there left, there were still many of these older inequalities that were left in place. Oftentimes, what you had in African countries, for example, were independence movements that had managed to develop very strong appeals to a broad part of the population that were mobilized through a long struggle for independence. And that was just not the case in the former Soviet Union, where really it was a top-down disillusion that occurred, largely orchestrated by Mikhail Gorbachev himself. And so when the Communist Party dissolved, there hadn't even had time to be a major opposition movement to coalesce in opposition to it. And so that's what I mean by it kind of being a baseline, in the sense that when the Communist Party collapsed, to some degree, it was almost like a clean slate. You didn't have organized parties already in place. The only one that you had, the Communist Party, was gone. You didn't have massive inequalities of a structural kind in society that could frame a politics of left and right. And so that really left these societies with kind of pure patronal politics. It really just was almost a pure instance of kind of who you know matters, and just these things that structure politics, these left-right divides, really didn't matter as much in there as they did in other places. Whereas I think in countries like Africa, what you saw after colonial rule ended was a lot of times it was the resistance movement that took power and then were able to structure politics and control it in a way through these parties that just did not exist in the Soviet Union. So you had these other factors there, or you had these massive inequalities that would form a natural basis for labor movements or wealthy, parties of the wealthy that would structure politics in a way that it wasn't structured in the former Soviet Union. So I think that's why we see in the former Soviet Union just a lot of gyrating back and forth between authoritarianism and democratization, whereas in other parts of the world we tend to see somewhat stabler authoritarianism or more solid movements towards democracy, with some exceptions in both cases.
So what determines which direction a country goes? It sounds like you're saying common histories, like the history really matters, the institutions really matter. What else would you say?
Well, in the longer run, and this isn't something I can really support empirically in my book, but it's what I think. And I think there is some limited evidence for it in the former Soviet cases. I think economic development in the long run will definitely have an effect, just because once societies become wealthy enough, and if that wealth becomes at least reasonably equitably distributed so that there's not just one class of super poor and one class of super rich, people will start becoming less dependent on patrons for their day-to-day survival. And to the extent that becomes the case, they start becoming more capable of autonomous action, which makes it harder for authoritarian leaders to use the mechanisms of their rule. I mean, they can do this for a long time through various repressive means, but inevitably there are going to be crises of some kind or other, or moments of succession where a longtime leader gets old or is expected to leave office for some other reason. And I think at those moments then, when countries are more economically developed, it becomes much more likely that you're going to get some kind of democratic outcome more stabilized. The people at a certain point are going to say, you know what, I think overall having a strong rule of law is more important to me than getting that next payment, you know, from the patron, because they start to have a bigger picture perspective, partly because their own day-to-day existence is less acutely dependent on these personalized relationships. And so I think that makes it possible for reform to happen. I mean, there is research in political science which indicates, at least at a broad level, over time, that this is the case, that economic development, the more economically developed a country is, the more likely that any attempt to democratize a country will succeed. And so it doesn't mean that kind of there's a direct relationship between more development automatically translating into more democracy, but more development just means that if there is an attempt at democratization, it's more likely to succeed. And over time, these various crises and random events or the appearance of a certain leader, these random events tend to hit countries eventually. And so I do think that economic development is one of the greater hopes for all this to be overcome, for countries actually to achieve a more democratic outcome.
You have said in one space that this is very cyclical kind of pattern. And then in another space, you had said that this is part of a longer pattern. Do you mean that these cycles are also evolutionary towards something else?
I think that might be a good way of putting it. I think in the short to medium term, you know, maybe the terms of a generation, I think we're likely to see these kind of cycles of politics. But over time, as long as these cycles don't become so destructive that they prevent any significant economic growth, over time we're going to see, you might think of it as kind of the amplitude of the cycles narrow. The swings to authoritarianism become less pronounced, and the swings towards democracy may be more likely to stick, at least or hang on for a little longer. So it's a kind of a gyrating pattern, but over time there's a larger trend that probably tends to take place. We've had almost 25 years now since the USSR collapsed in 1991. We haven't seen this yet, so I do think this is a longer-term trend. Even though we've had substantial economic growth in some of the countries, although many of those years have been years of significant economic crisis, but I think it's possible that over the course of the next generation, the next 25 years perhaps, that we may start seeing a significant trend away from this politics. But again, it's hard to say. Right now, the trend in the region does not look good, including economically.
I imagine it could also trend the other way.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm an optimist by nature, thinking that, well, eventually countries are going to grow. But absolutely, if we see growth that is not very robust or even negative economic growth, especially if these countries wind up in a period of war, as we seem to see happening in Ukraine now, these patterns could continue in principle indefinitely. So I don't see any necessary trend towards economic growth or democracy, although, you know, one would hope that, you know, leaders at least have enough vision to see that this is in their interest, which I think it is, to do that. I think one thing that some of the countries of the former Soviet bloc at least have in their favor is the proximity to the European Union. Of course, the European Union is struggling, and if it somehow dissolves or succumbs, I think that would be a major blow to, you know, the prospects for democratization in this region, because it really holds out some hope of these countries at least being able to share a little bit of the wealth of Europe, and gives them some extra incentive to try and you know, minimize the worst aspects of this kind of patronal politics. And so some of those countries that are closest to Europe at least have that hope. And so that's another factor that I think can, you know, help these countries along. But again, I think it's a longer term phenomenon. We have some countries even in the European Union now, such as Bulgaria or Romania, that are highly patronalistic in their politics. And so, you know, they've managed to stay more or less democratic. And I think that has a lot to do with the influence of the European Union. But at the same time, you know, they have not radically transformed their societies. Progress in combating corruption, for example, has been quite low. There are no panaceas out there, unfortunately.
Henry Hale, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you very much for the invitation. I enjoyed it.
Henry Hale is the Associate Professor of Political Science and International Affairs and co-director of the Program on New Approaches to Research and Security in Eurasia. He's the author of Why Not Parties in Russia? Democracy, Federalism, and the State, Developments in Russian Politics, and his latest, Patronal Politics. When we come back, how are the so-called extractive industries related to conflicts and corruption? Stay tuned. You're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. What is the relationship between minerals such as oil, diamonds, gold, and conflict, authoritarianism, and poverty? This week's scholars have spent years studying how these so-called extractive industries, mining and drilling, impact people's lives, their governance, and the environment throughout the world. How can countries so rich in mineral wealth remain mired in so much poverty? Three experts join us. Jeffrey Mance is a professor of anthropology at George Mason University. His publications include Improvisational Economies, Coltan Production in the Eastern Congo, and How a Huckster Becomes a Custodian of Moral Markets. Michael Ross also joins us. Michael Ross is a professor of political science at the University of California, Los Angeles, and director of the Center for Southeast Asian Studies. He's the author of The Oil Curse, How Petroleum Shapes the Development of Nations, and Timber Booms and Institutional Breakdown in Southeast Asia. Susanna Sawyer also joins us. Susanna Sawyer is a professor of anthropology at the University of California, Davis. She is the author of Crude Chronicles, Indigenous Politics, Multinational Oil, and Neoliberalism in Ecuador. She's also co-editor of The Politics of Resource Extraction, Indigenous Peoples, Corporations, and the State. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Scholar Circle. I'd like to start with the Congo. Jeff Mance, you've been studying it. It's experienced one of the most brutal conflicts, primarily over this mineral, coltan, that we use for our cell phones. You made some comparisons, one to blood diamonds, one to sugar plantations by the European colonies in the Caribbean. How does this compare to those?
Coltan, or columbite tantalite, is this dense silicate. It's a very heavy mineral that you find in the ground that essentially you're able to take the tantalite out of it and turn and refine it into something called tantalum, and this is used as a heat-resistant conductor. What a lot of scientists called the holy grail, the digital age, is that we needed mobile devices and other kinds of electronics that were able to hold a charge for a long period of time. So essentially it took from cell phones from being sort of a product, a commodity that was kind of servicing, you know, the sort of more wealthy into a different sort of space where, you know, this was the kind of commodity that was available to the rest of the planet, that everybody could have a cell phone. And in fact, people do. One of the interesting things about the cell phone in Africa and the minerals that come out of the Congo is that you have this coming full circle, and the cell phones, when a militia comes over and tries to take over a coltan mine or a village, the first thing they do is confiscate all the cell phones, and they've used in cell phones in the past to coordinate their attacks on villages and so forth. So there's this sort of circularity to the product. Historically, sugar had an enormous role to play in terms of the transformations that kind of were ushering in industrialization in Europe and in Britain specifically. So the sugar economies of the Caribbean took sugar from being this kind of product that was servicing the elite, that was really designed originally was a spice. Then it got turned into this product that was kind of widely available and everybody wanted it in their tea, and it became sort of this plebeian kind of commodity. So you see it had a similar sort of effect. In the process of becoming this widely consumed commodity, it kind of grew these industrial industrial centers like London. And so you have the same sort of phenomena happening with the digital age and the sort of economic transformations that are unfolding there. So that's kind of the parallel that one makes to that. Of course, the blood diamond angle is that whereas, you know, blood diamonds are a luxury item, the difference with these items in the Congo is that the conflict's happening around coltan historically, and the problems that the Congo has faced, including the deaths of millions of people, most from starvation, as a result really of trafficking in a mineral that's essential for a product that most of us own.
When you went to the Congo and you studied the process, it was all pretty devastating in terms of how entire communities become swept up into this and the conflict that came out of it and how the process goes through other countries to then ultimately end up in the cell phones. Can you give us a quick walk through all of that?
Sure. There are some government-controlled mines, and there are some sort of more formal mining centers and so forth. But most of the people who are involved in coltan production are involved as small-scale artisanal miners. And there's literally hundreds of thousands of them. The interesting thing about this is, as much as one is inclined to demonize the trade, which is precisely what happened with Dodd-Frank, it's actually an important source of labor. But essentially, you have a bunch of different stakeholders in this, and a lot of it makes its way illegally, or illicitly, I should say, mostly out through Rwanda, and gets rebranded as some other kind of coltan other than Congolese coltan. So in the case of Rwanda, they'll claim that Rwanda, according to the USGS, eclipses Congo in terms of its coltan production, which is just absolutely asinine. There's no way a small country like that that is on the wrong side of the geological fault could really exploit whatever reserves it has. Reserves are doubtful at that. So you have a lot of it being what I call laundered. There's a lot of mineral laundering that goes on that contributes to the rebranding of coltan as Rwandan coltan or as, you know, Australian coltan or as coltan from some other part of the world. And we've had that going on for quite some time.
Now, Michael Ross, you've looked at this in big picture, but you've also looked at some Asian countries and their extractive industries. You've looked at oil, timber, diamonds. Where do you see this, and how does it compare to what we're hearing from Jeff Metz?
There are a lot of similarities, particularly in Indonesia and in Myanmar, where you have both countries very fragmented ethnically, dozens and dozens of different ethnic and linguistic groups. And often there's a lot of resentment about foreign companies or outside companies coming in and digging up local resources and making a huge profit over it, especially when the profits go to the government or to some company and the local people are stuck with all of the environmental and social harm done by some very large and often very dirty mining operations. In Indonesia, you see this all across this, you know, this vast archipelago from Aceh in the west to West Papua in the far east. And the dynamics seem, you know, they sound very similar to what Jeff was describing in the Congo.
In terms of the conflict and the corruption and the kind of laundering sense of it?
Mm-hmm. I think probably the closest comparison in Asia would be in Myanmar, where you have the central government not really controlling that much in the kind of peripheral parts of the country. And in those peripheral regions, you have sometimes economies that are built around the extraction of minerals, often controlled by some warlord or whatever faction has the most weaponry, the most kind of brute force. And, you know, people can labor away under brutal conditions and make almost no money from it.
And when they don't, they can also get very punished by the people controlling that.
That's right. Perhaps, you know, what's remarkable and distinctive about the Congo case that Jeff was describing is, you know, this sort of transnational connection to the devices that so many of us carry around and that it's so central to kind of the modern information economy that gives everybody a kind of intimate link to this, you know, almost scandalous extraction process going on the other side of the world.
Now, oil also is an extractive industry. It's quite different for obvious reasons and controlled by multinational corporations most of the time. Susanna Sawyer, you've studied this in Latin America, particularly in the Amazon area, and you found some exploitations there that contrast here. How would you compare these?
Well, I think there are some differences, just especially with the work that Jeffrey's been involved in, where he's looking largely at coltan that's deriving, that's coming from artisanal mining for the most part, which is very different from large-scale multinational oil exploration and extraction, at least in the Amazonian area. My research has looked specifically at the conflicts that have emerged between multinational corporations and indigenous peoples in the Amazon region. And for the most part, the largest, most significant effect of those operations has been the environmental degradation and contamination that has resulted. There are, at times, during extraction, well, exploration and extraction, there are some benefits that local communities can encounter, depending on the types of arrangements that get built and mediated, negotiated with local communities. But they're often very short-term. They're often based on not a full understanding on the part of indigenous peoples of what is at stake. And for the most part, they end up collapsing and coming back to haunt many people who have engaged in them.
I remember a couple of lawsuits, one in Burma, one in Nigeria, against some of these oil giants. And I know there's also been one in Ecuador that I think you've been following. Yeah. But there's been quite a contrast. I think the Burma one resulted in a very large settlement for the indigenous people in there in the region. Nigeria did not turn out that way. One was Unocal. Chevron was Nigeria. And the Ecuador one is also Chevron. Is that right?
That's correct. I mean, the lawsuits are different. They're not necessarily directly comparable, although they are with oil companies. But the one in Ecuador has specifically to do with the long-term effects of oil operations initiated by Texaco, but a corporation that merged with Chevron. So now it's a lawsuit against Chevron for environmental contamination and then the health effects of that contamination. It's been a really long-standing, very complex lawsuit, but ultimately resulted in Ecuador in a ruling against Chevron, finding it has $9 billion liability that essentially will be used for, should it ever be recuperated or recovered, should that money would be used for largely environmental remediation. Ontario Court of Appeals that said that the Ecuadorians did indeed, the Ecuadorian plaintiffs did indeed have a right to use Canada as a jurisdiction through which they could then make a claim for the enforcement of the Ecuadorian ruling. So that was a court decision that was overruling a lower court Ontario decision. So it was an appeals court decision that was really paving the way for them to think of Canada as a jurisdiction, a forum, a legal forum through which they could enforce the Ecuadorian ruling.
So what we've got here is several different scenarios, but all of them resulting in a kind of exploitation. Michael Ross, this is an area that you've been studying in this big picture way about the relationship between some of these extractive industries and problems such as conflict and corruption and authoritarianism. Let's look at these one by one. Perhaps let's start with conflict and the relationship that you're finding between extractive industries and civil war or other kinds of violent conflicts. What are the conditions?
You know, there's maybe 50 countries around the world that extract a significant amount of oil or gas. Many of them are exporters, and the number is growing as there's been new investment, new exploration, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, but also parts of Latin America. And yet when you look around the world and you look at these 50 or so countries, you find that they have unusually high rates of civil war. And often these wars seem to be around these oil facilities. And I think the most common pattern, one that we've sort of already touched on, is that when oil is found in the territory of a group that feels disenfranchised, marginalized, they get resentful. And there may be the government or companies may be anticipating this and may be especially repressive in those regions. I think we saw that in Sudan and Indonesia at one point. And it may be that there are local insurgencies or independence movements that use this kind of as a rallying cry. You know, they are stealing our minerals. They are stealing our wealth. If we were getting our fair share, we would be much better off now. Countries that often think they're going to, you know, get this sort of leap forward in wealth and development from discovering oil often does not seem to find themselves mired in these endemic conflicts where a lot of the profits just get squandered on long-running insurgencies and repression.
Jeff Mance, would you say that this fits in what you've seen in the Congo?
Yeah, I mean, the situation in the Congo is, you see some interesting parallels. What I like about what Mike Ross is saying is that a refreshing way of looking at it from what typically has been regarded as kind of a resource curse hypothesis propounded by the economist Jeffrey Sachs and others about the tendency for countries that have that are wealthy in resources to sort of be at bottom end of the economic chain in terms of the benefits that accrue to their society from having these resources. There seems to be historical evidence for this, but you're left with this sort of nasty kind of taste in your mouth that, actually it may not be the existence of the resources and the inability to exploit them, but the fact that they're exploited by outsiders and that there's not appropriate forms of accountability that result from this. That's something that you see very much articulated by Congolese. If you comment to a Congolese person on poverty in the Congo, you say, you know, wow, this looks poor, the first thing that they'll sort of jolt back at you and say, the Congo is a very, very wealthy country, and be fairly adamant about that in terms of their pride in that and the fact that they have these resources and, you know, that anything can grow there and anything can be found in the ground. And they really see the problems they have for what they are, and that is that they're facilitated by outsiders who exploit particular kinds of disagreements that people have over land and resources and exploit people's goodwill and pillage and do all sorts of things like that. So I would say, yes, that the resources themselves, these resource curse kinds of literature sometimes leave you thinking that you kind of forget about the people in all of this. You know, where are the people and how they feel about it? And in fact, it's very much, Congolese very much have a very real recognition of what the political economy is going on the ground. They're not naive to it at all. And where they choose to direct their energy is precisely at those points of conflict.
When you say they talk about the outsiders that are coming in and essentially robbing them of their wealth, are they speaking of the West or are they speaking of other African countries?
Well, I think most often they talk about it as in terms of Rwanda exploitation. Rwanda and Uganda in particular really have exploited the situation in the Congo to their advantage. The governments have and a number of individuals, Kigali and Kampala, who are now part of the Kigali and Kampala elites, have made themselves very wealthy off this conflict. That's, I think, where they see most, you know, directly the connections there. The West is a bit more indirect. The French and Americans are sometimes picked on specifically by the Congolese, but that's largely because we have these close diplomatic connections to Rwanda and, you know, provide a lot of aid for them. That produces a lot of rumors and mysteries and those kinds of things. But it's not like you have American companies going directly into the Congo and setting up shop, this more elaborate chain that takes place. So they're taking raw minerals out and they work their way through Malaysia or Beijing or any number of other places, and eventually it ends up in an iPhone or something like that, which is an American company. And people understand the commodity chain, but the sort of proximate kind of wrath is more directed at their neighbors.
Susanna Sawyer, what about in Latin America where you're studying?
Well, it's slightly different with respect to oil, and I guess also with respect to mining somewhat. There haven't been, I mean, historically, yes, there have been large insurgency movements in Latin America, but more recently, in the last few, the last decade, two decades, there has emerged a lot of conflict around resource extraction, but that the forms of conflict that have emerged are not armed. They're not, so they're not local insurgencies in the same sense. They're definitely directed when they're large multinational operations. They're definitely directed toward the outside to some extent, but also very much around national legislation and the national government and wanting to. A lot of indigenous organizations who have built collaborations with large environmental groups and more progressive entities within different countries have built strong alliances for rewriting constitutions, for rewriting mineral laws, rewriting hydrocarbon laws, such that in some countries, and you see this in Ecuador, you see this in Bolivia, to some extent in Peru, although that seems to be more emerging, is a whole different form of wanting to imagine what development might look like otherwise, that doesn't rely on resource extractions, that these are actually discussions that are taken seriously. They're not seen as they were maybe 30 years ago as fairly peripheral, but now they're part of the mainstream conversations around resource extraction, and it largely has to do with questions of the environment, of indigenous rights, of, in the case of Ecuador and Bolivia, of the rights of nature around global warming. So there's a different conversation that's also been generated through these conflicts.
So I wonder, one of the things that you had written in one of your pieces, you were talking about a paradox that had emerged, and that had to do with these constitutions and laws all over the world that were supposed to be protecting the rights of indigenous people, and yet they're still experiencing similar exploitation. Do you think that's turned a corner? Because it sounds like you're saying it has.
Well, it really depends on where. In Latin America, in particular countries, especially countries that have, well, in South America, have significant indigenous populations, it's not that it's turned a corner, but the whole debate has shifted. And it's not as though there's a victory in any sense from an indigenous point of view, but the debate has radically changed and transformed. And yet you go to other countries in Southeast Asia or the Pacific, in sub-Saharan Africa, where that's definitely not the case. And oftentimes there are spaces in Southeast Asia or sub-Saharan Africa where even the notion of indigenous rights isn't really clear. You know, even the definition of who actually is an indigenous person is hotly debated. So you see different ways in which this confluence of legislative, constitutional, even UN-mandated and corporate proclamations and guidelines for taking into consideration indigenous peoples and the environment take shape differently in different places.
All right.
This is Michael Ross. Can I get in on this?
Please.
I think, you know, what Susanna's saying is really, really important and easy to overlook. Many of us who follow these issues are aware of these stories, like in the Congo, like in Ecuador, of these endemic struggles that seem kind of hopeless. But in particularly the last, say, 5 years, there's been a whole movement responding to this. And we see now even governments in places where you wouldn't expect this kind of efforts to improve things really taking this issue seriously. So in places like in Mongolia, Mexico, Guinea, suddenly governments are influenced largely, I think, by NGO movements and by other international organizations working on this, adopting reforms that really could be meaningful, you know, that really, really might make a difference. It's a little bit early to say, but the struggle, which at one time was really all very kind of micro level on the ground around these extraction sites, now is also taking place in the halls of governments in capital cities. And that's actually a pretty interesting and exciting thing.
You've led me right into where I wanted to go, Michael Ross, because you've also explored some of the policy changes that could have an impact. You've talked about, for example, decentralization being one possible way of approaching a future policy. If you were going to lay out what you thought were the most important changes, policy-wise, globally, locally, what would you say?
First of all, I think the first thing that has to be said is that there are no magic solutions. There are no silver bullets here. Everybody in the development world always thinks there's some magic answer, and if we just implemented it, and I just don't think that's the case. I think, as Susanna was implying, you know, that you go from case to case, and in different local conditions, people are struggling to find different kinds of solutions. I think everywhere it's important, though, that there be a lot more transparency. You know, the minerals industry and the oil industry in particular is vast and dominates large parts of the world, and yet it's extraordinarily opaque. I mean, you go down to the, you know, to the gas station on the corner, and you have no idea where that stuff comes from. Everywhere else you go to buy something, it has a little country of origin label, but not at the gas station. So bringing transparency, I think, is, if nothing else, the first step in a lot of different situations towards getting policies right, towards fixing some of these problems.
Just a reminder that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. And we're talking about the relationship between the so-called extractive industries, such as mining and drilling, and conflict, poverty, and authoritarianism.
Jeff Mansk, you've written a bit about some of the policy changes that have already started. For example, here in the U.S., I think it was Dodd-Frank Act. How do you see this having an impact yet, if it is? And if not, how do you see it having an impact?
There's an interesting sort of difference here in the case of the Congo. You don't have, like, very many indigenous sorts of rights and environmental movements and that sort of formalization kind of thing in the Congo with respect to non-governmental organizations. That has more to do with the fact that until 1996 they were backed by a U.S. finance dictator who was, you know, an enemy of communism and ruled with very much with an iron fist. So you didn't have these kinds of alternative forms of civil society kind of emerging. But so it's bit more of a specific case. But in the case of the Congo, you have scores of these organizations that are coming in from elsewhere. It used to be that they were very concerned about sort of the ecological damage in the Congo about 10 years ago. Increasingly, they were concerned about the humanitarian damage, particularly around gang rape by soldiers and these sorts of things. A few of these organizations in particular that were responsible for getting Dodd-Frank, Section 1302 added to the Dodd-Frank Act, the Financial Reform Act. And this basically created a sort of stigma around Congolese coltan as well as cassiterite, it's tin, wolframite, which is tungsten, and gold. And it basically requires the SEC to require companies to exercise due diligence in proving that their minerals are not coming from conflict zones. Sounds all great on paper, except there's not really a good way of verifying this. And the problem that I've written about actually is the problem actually is not Congolese coltan. It's all the other coltan that's laundered everywhere else. That's really where the stigma should be. I really don't see anything kind of changing there because of the SEC getting involved in this process. In fact, I see it as potentially officious and just a new form of regulation kind of imposing itself on the Congolese that they'll see as any other kind of colonial, post-colonial sort of apparatus. That where the hope kind of lies, I think, is in some initiatives that we see on the ground where Congolese have decided maybe that if they demonstrate transparency in their own mineral process and use social media to document it, put RFID tags on bags, and start doing this on their own, then they can have a, you know, genuinely Congolese-certified method of demonstrating clean coltan or clean gold or any of these kinds of things. And that, I think, is just good for the Congo in general. I mean, I think the Congo's 500-year history of problems is really related to outsiders meddling in it and things the Congolese are perfectly capable of doing on their own. So that's where the significant transformation needs to be taking place.
Now, the war is officially over there, but I understand it's still pretty heavy in terms of the conflict. And some people argue that the current conflict going on in the Central African Republic has some similar dynamics, and of course, refugee camps being filled since they're right next to each other. Do you have a sense of what's going on now?
They're two different conflicts. They're not completely unrelated, but they relate to different kinds of concerns. They're parallel sorts of concerns. They're parallel sorts of dilemmas and problems. There's leadership issues. There are, you know, conflicts over land scarcity on the ground that translate into ethnic kinds of disagreements. There's political economic dimensions to this involving the trafficking of certain items, most of which goes out through East Africa. There's overlaps with these two situations, both being in the Francophone world, and they neighbor one another, and then there's been conflicts. Kony is the most famous of which is the Lord's Resistance Army is kind of, you know, wandered into the CAR after being in the Congo for quite some time. So it's a series of problems that you see in as well in South Sudan and Chad and lots of other parts of Africa, but they're not directly related in a real sense.
Michael Ross?
I have to say, I really don't know much about the CAR conflict. There's always some resource dimension to most conflicts, particularly as you get to poorer and poorer countries, and people's living more and more depends on, you know, their interaction with natural resources, then you always see something. But I can't really say that I know anything about what kind of role, if any, it plays in this conflict.
Now, you have done some work around poverty and resources as well, and you just mentioned the issue of poverty. So I'm wondering if you could help us to understand how this is happening, where you have such, like in the case of the Congo, you've got an essentially rich landscape, and yet you've got such poverty going on in the country. What is the relationship there? Maybe it's also tied into the governance question that you also looked at.
Mm-hmm.
Is it tied into governance?
Yes, I very much think so. I think there's a lot of different kinds of economic activity that don't depend that much on what the government does. You know, you can have a pretty corrupt government like you do in, say, China, but you can still have thriving industries and factories and retail businesses. The mineral industry, the extractive industry, is kind of different. The government always plays a central role, partly because in almost all countries of the world, the U.S. being the big exception, whatever that's valuable that's below the ground belongs to the government. And so the interaction between companies and governments is critical. And if the government is corrupt and weak and unaccountable, then you're almost certain to see that the revenues, the money that comes from extracting resources is going to be squandered. You really need an accountable government, a transparent government, a government that's strong enough to stand up to companies and get their fair share, to regulate them properly. You need to have all of the elements of good governance, and they become even more important in countries that are based on extractive industries than they are in just your average country.
May I interject for a second?
Please, Susanna Sawyer.
I just wanted to pick up on what Michael was saying a little bit and bring back his thought about transparency also. I absolutely agree with what Michael's saying. And then there's maybe another dimension that we should think about, and that is at least the role of particular large extractive corporations, their role in sustaining and generating particular corrupt practices within government, so that governance and government accountability and government transparency is so often intertwined in actual corporate activity. And it seems that one of the places to really think about transparency, and this is, you know, more speculative, would be through imagining maybe a multiplicity of different actors involved at a larger, maybe even UN-type level of structure. Because to me, in my research, both in Latin America and then other research in the extractive industries that you had mentioned earlier, it's the relationship often between corporations and governments and the lack of transparency between those two that is critical also to imagining a more just reality for people in countries and across the world. I would just make a plug for, you know, the United Nations has a special representative, John Ruggie, faculty member at Harvard, who has done extensive work on the relationship between business and human rights. And the work that the group of scholars that he's engaged with across the world might be a good platform for building larger and larger networks.
Susanna's points are so salient and so right on. We forget that when it comes to these relationships between governments, particularly in low-income countries, and these companies, the companies are so much vastly larger than the governments. I mean, the entire economy of a country like the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, is only a small fraction of the size of, say, a Shell or an Exxon. These companies have enormous influence in these places. And even though international initiatives have focused up to this point really on bringing transparency to governments, companies, which are so important and so wealthy and so influential, have kind of been flying under the radar, and you know, a lot of this stuff just doesn't apply to them. So I think the point is very well taken that Susanna made.
Do you think the free trade agreements that have been occurring for the last couple of decades have obfuscated this even more?
This is Jeff Mance. Absolutely. There's a huge literature devoted precisely to that question. I think what's most obscuring about this is the fact that people tend to think of free trade in a very sort of digested sort of way. That means opening up of economies. And actually, what it does, particularly in the case of the WTO, it creates an international administrative legal apparatus that polices different kinds of agreements. And like any kind of set of international, like any kind of legal forum, there are certain people that have resources to pursue certain kinds of claims. There are certain kinds of stakeholders that are better litigators than others. And we have to remember that these free trade agreements are between countries, not between companies.
Thank you so very much for sharing your research and your thoughts with us. Jeff Mance, Michael Ross, Susanna Sawyer, thank you so very much.
My pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
Jeffrey Mance is a professor of anthropology at George Mason University. His publications include Improvisational Economies, Colton Production in the Eastern Congo, and How a Huckster Becomes a Custodian of Moral Markets. Michael Ross is a professor of political science at the University of California, Los Angeles, and director of the Center for Southeast Asian Studies. He's the author of The Oil Curse, How Petroleum Shapes the Development of Nations, and Timber Booms and Institutional Breakdown in Southeast Asia. Susanna Sawyer is a professor of anthropology at the University of California, Davis. She is the author of Crude Chronicles, Indigenous Politics, Multinational Oil, and Neoliberalism in Ecuador. She's also co-editor of The Politics of Resource Extraction, Indigenous Peoples, Corporations, and the State. That is it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests, and extra special thanks to Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, and Huatemoc Aileman, who produced this show each week, and to Sud Dongre, our webmaster and web host. Most of all, thank you for listening, and if you missed any part of the show, you can go to scholarcircle.org or armudian.com or kpfk.org. You can also hear us on Stitcher, on iTunes. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at @armudian. See you next week.